Well, Amy and I are currently looking for a new car. Now, I don't say that because I'm expecting anyone to offer us one. I say that because as we're looking for a new car, we are faced with an inevitable problem. The problem of choice. Which car to buy? You see, it's a problem because there are pros and there are cons to each car that you might look at. Within the same price range, you could buy a similar Ford or a Honda or a Seat or a Toyota. And whilst some people might like one of those above another, they're all fairly similar, aren't they? See, we're used to those sorts of choices in our day and age. It's not just with cars. We have choices for everything, choices between similar options. And for some, that same way of looking at things, that same expectation, carries over into our overall worldview, of issues of faith or religion. They all seem to fall into the same category of choice. All the options are viewed as being pretty much the same, comparable, with pros and cons to each one. And so you just need to pick the one that you like the most. The one that works for you, whether that's Eastern mysticism or secular humanism or pleasure-seeking hedonism or the God of the Bible. All are considered to be the same. You just need to choose. That is the mindset of many today. And it's one that seems to have been shared with the people of Judah in Isaiah's day too. See, Isaiah, the author of this book of prophecy, was writing to Judah, the people of God at that time. And he has pointed out that they have turned away from the Lord, from God. They are not placing their trust in him as they ought to do. Instead, they're looking elsewhere. They have chosen to look around the world around them and look for other options, to look for other salvation providers. In this instance, it's Egypt that they are looking to. We've seen over the last few chapters that Judah has made an alliance with Egypt so that they can fight together against the upcoming threat of invasion from the Assyrian Empire. That was the great threat at the time. And so this is the choice that they have made, trusting Egypt rather than the Lord. And in this section of the book, Isaiah has sought to make it painfully clear that though this is a choice that they have made, there is no wisdom in such a choice. It's not a like-for-like swap that they've made. In trusting Egypt or the world or whatever kingdom it might be, all they find is emptiness. Whereas if they were to trust in the Lord, the King, his people would enjoy fullness. Fullness of salvation, fullness of joy. And so that's the theme that we're looking at today, this choice between these two that we see in Judah and that we see played out in our own lives as well. And the first point that we see here, the first point that we see why Isaiah is pointing out that this is no real choice at all is because, of course, of who the king is, who the Lord is. And so that's going to be our first point, look to the king. And to see that, we're going to look at verses 1 to 6. Look to the king. In the last few chapters, Isaiah has been speaking of the threat that will come from Assyria. And so he begins here in verse 1, presumably speaking about Assyria. He describes them as a destroyer who hasn't been destroyed. This is a kingdom that has conquered everyone so far. They are doing well for themselves. They were also known to go back on their word. They weren't trustworthy. After all, they were the big bad power in the world, and so they didn't need to honor their commitments. They would take gold offered to them to acquire peace, and then they would just go and attack anyway. And so Isaiah calls them traitors who have not been betrayed. This is an empire that has succeeded in all that they have tried to do. They are conquering well. But the Lord will put an end to them. They will be destroyed. They will be betrayed. They haven't so far, but they will. They will crumble. You see, this is a point that Isaiah has tried to make time and time again. There is no rival, no true rival to the Lord in his power. The king rules. And so verses 3 and 4, at the tumultuous noise, peoples flee. When you lift yourself up, nations are scattered, and your spoil is gathered as the caterpillar gathers. As locusts sleep, it is leapt upon. You see, the Lord is the ultimate conqueror. He is sovereign. He is king. He is only to rise up. He has only to lift his voice to be heard, and all scatter before him. And so if he moves in might to save, then he will save. There is no stopping him. And so Isaiah lists in verses 5 and 6 the great blessings that he will surely bring to his people, to Zion. And I'm just going to list them here. Justice and righteousness, this perfect rule. Stability rather than change and chance and chaos. Abundance of salvation. I love that phrase there. It's not just some salvation here or there in this battle or that battle, but maybe not the other. It is an abundance of salvation, full and complete salvation. And his people are then blessed with wisdom, knowledge, and a right fear of the Lord. Now, I've gone through all of that quite quickly, but the point is clear. This is one choice that they have, the king. And such a description should be enough to seal the deal. The choice is obvious, especially as the Lord, as king of his people, already has a spotless track record of doing just this for his people. He has saved them mightily time and time again. They just have to open their history books and see. Whenever his people have trusted him, they have known blessings in abundance. Whether they look back to Exodus from slavery in Egypt, or the strength that they were blessed with when they entered into the promised land, or the salvation that came time and time again through the judges, but then of course they went their own way and it all went wrong again, but then another judge was sent and they were saved. Or the blessings that they enjoyed when the kings trusted the Lord, which wasn't particularly for very long. There's lots of bad kings, but some good ones there, and the people were blessed. So this is one of their options. Imagine, for example, an election where someone was running for office who had a spotless record. I know it's hard to imagine, if only that could be true. But this person who's running for office, they always delivered on all that they had promised. And every year that they had been in office, the nation prospered, did better and better and better. But then when it comes to election time, people vote against them anyway. Why? Why would they do such a thing? Because they just want a change? It's time to mix things up a little bit. Variety is the spice of life, because another candidate with an awful track record promises perhaps to cater for their particular desires. One small group's particular desires, though it would be at the expense of the common good, and so they vote for them. Perhaps because this other candidate is smoother or funnier or more their kind of person. It would be foolish. It would be crazy. And then when that new and untrustworthy candidate comes into office, it will be no surprise that they run the country into the ground. And so it is with Judah's trust in Egypt. They can't compare to this glorious king. All they can offer, ultimately, is emptiness instead. And so that is our second point. Know that the kingless gain only emptiness. Verses 7 through to 12. Know that the kingless gain only emptiness. See, Judah, as I've said, have put their trust in an alliance with Egypt. And oh, what high hopes they had. These were, verse 7, their heroes, their envoys of peace. But when all of their promises come to nothing, when Assyria attacks and the alliance crumbles, these heroes, these envoys, will be crying in the streets. They will be weeping bitterly. Verse 8, we see that the promised prosperity isn't delivered. The covenants, the agreements that they've made are broken, and the land lies in ruins. ruins, verse 9. See, the promises are not and cannot be kept. They weren't. Egypt offers so much, but delivers nothing to them. We've seen that week after week, haven't we, as we've gone through these chapters. This kingless approach offers only emptiness, only disappointment, only hurt for them, only destruction. And Isaiah spells this out in verses 11 and 12. Verse 11, we read there, "You conceive chaff, you give birth to stubble." Meaning that their plans come to nothing. Their best efforts, their cleverest plans, are no more than straw, useless, the waste, the stuff that just gets thrown away, blown away. But then he goes further. It's not just useless, is it? It's actually harmful. It's self-destructive. Second half of verse 11, going on to verse 12. "Your breath is a fire that will consume you, and the peoples will be as if burned to lime, like thorns cut down that are burned in the fire." Your breath is a fire that will consume you. They will be the cause of their own ruin. Their own plans burn them. This proved true with the alliance between Judah and Egypt, and it still holds true today. With the promises that the world makes to us, the things that we are offered, what the world offers, what the world promises, is ultimately emptiness. Of course, the heroes of, say, secular humanism, or the envoys of materialistic atheism, the spirit of our age, whatever it might be, they won't speak of their promises in quite that way, will they? They won't say it's emptiness. That's not very appealing. No, instead, they are offered in such grand ways. They say to us, you can be free to do whatever you want. Sounds grand, doesn't it? You can throw off the king of the Bible, you can throw off the Lord, and you can instead put on that mantle of kingship. You can rule yourself. And you can be anything that you want to be. You can craft your own purpose and meaning. Now, these are the messages that we're fed in films and novels, or if you go online, the motivational messages, pictures that you see there, this is what we hear from every single possible place. It's there, this message, this grand offer. But then, though we have this offer made to us, left, right, and center, there's the fine print. Henry Ford, the man who streamlined the manufacturing of the Ford car, the Model T, which was very affordable at the time, so I'm told, said of his cars, "Any customer can have a car painted any color that he wants, so long as it is black." And the world likewise makes these grand promises to us. But in the very same breath, we'll say that you are nothing but a cosmic accident. You are stardust, which is meant to sound amazing, isn't it? It's grand. We're made from the very stuff of stars, but when it comes down to it, it's still just dust. That's the lesson that we then get from the classroom. That's the lesson that we are taught. That we are here today and we are gone tomorrow, and the universe could not care less. So you can be whatever you want. You can choose your own purpose, as long as it's only temporary, small, and ultimately meaningless. And we then wonder, don't we, why our children and teenagers and young adults are facing such dissatisfaction and depression. We're giving them these two messages, building them up and then tearing them down. Or perhaps we can look at the fact that people are shocked. They are shocked when the dream of fame and success is slapped on to every magazine and seen there on every reality TV show, and yet the rich and famous still experience breakdowns, crumbling relationships, or are led to suicide. It's all empty. It's empty, and it's self-destructive and harmful. Go your own way, we say. Be yourself, do whatever you want to do. That's the message that we have been told time and time again. It was the message that was certainly part of the sexual revolution. And it's a message that still persists today, and yet our culture is still reeling from the denigrating effects of that, with people doing what they want, therefore leading to others being used and abused and dehumanized. Our breath is a fire that is consuming us, burned as if to lime. It is empty. But of course, this isn't meant to be our only option. This isn't our only choice. We don't need to be kingless. Because as we've already seen, the king is there, the Lord is there. And those who follow him find the opposite of what we see there. Not emptiness, but instead fullness. And so our third point, know that the king's people enjoy fullness. And we see this in verses 13 through to 24. Now, before we look at those verses, it's just worth taking a moment to try to place when this is meant to take place, when this is meant to be. See, one of the issues with Isaiah or with biblical prophecy is that we go from talking about events that were current at the time when it was written, you know, the alliance with Egypt, we read things about that, and then suddenly it will switch to going to the immediate future, the destruction of Assyria, for example, which is, of course, past for us. And then we seem to shoot forward to a time in the future, but it doesn't specify when. And so this coming blessing that we're going to read here from verses 13 through to 24, when is that meant to be? Is that when they're going to go off into exile, when they return from exile? Maybe in part, maybe there's some blessing there when they return to the Lord. Is it when the king comes, this king that Isaiah has already spoken about in this this prophecy, the Messiah? Is it when Jesus comes? Well, certainly in a sense, and when he builds his church, there are many blessings. But there is surely more to come, some ultimate fulfillment. And so that's how biblical prophecy often works. There is some partial fulfillment. There is then some more partial fulfillment. And then we look to the future. And we wait for the full fulfillment of all his promises. And I think that's what we have here. We have many different aspects that may have been fulfilled, at least in part, but we are looking to that final fulfillment when the Lord returns again. And so what we have here, as we look at the king's people, we have a lesson for all people at all times, a call to people to become the king's people, with the promises that will ultimately be theirs if they heed the call to trust in the king. And so with that said, what do we learn about the king's people here in these verses? And the short answer is a lot. And I'll try to condense it down, though we will miss some of the detail. But verses 13 to 15, this is a bit that I'll condense down the most. We have a description of who the king's people are. And in brief, they are those who turn from the ways of the world to trust in the work of God. They are those who are called not to do, but to acknowledge the work of the Lord, the saving work that Isaiah has already described, to acknowledge what he has done, and then to live this out in their lives. These are the king's people. But we're going to focus not on who the king's people are, but on verses 16 to 24, because here we see the contrast between the kingless and the king's people truly ramped up. We see what the king's people enjoy. And it is everything. That's why I say we learn a lot here. They get to enjoy everything. So let's read verses 16 through to 24. And I think this is the best way that I can think of doing it. We'll go through these verses and we'll stop along the way to draw out some of what is said. So from verse 16, he will dwell on the heights. His place of defense will be the fortress of the rocks. The king's people are perfectly protected. They are unassailable. The term there that is used for the rocks is meant to be like a cliff face. It's as if this fortress is on a cliff. You can't just go up to it with a ladder or with a rope. You can't do what the Assyrians, or the Babylonians and the Persians would do, diverting a river to try and take out the foundations of a wall and conquer it. And whilst it might be impressive, it's not it's not unassailable. No, this cannot be conquered. The Lord's people are perfectly protected. We continue. His bread will be given him. His water will be sure. Your eyes will behold the king in his beauty. They will see a land that stretches afar. Your heart will muse on the terror. Where is he who counted? Where is he who weighed the tribute? Where is he who counted the towers? You will see no more the insolent people, the people of an obscure speech that you cannot comprehend, stammering in a tongue that you cannot understand. You see, Judah are going to face this judgment as Assyria come in and as Babylon come in, these people of another tongue coming in and conquering them. But that will all be undone, and instead they will be safe. The Lord's people will be able to look back. The king's people can look back, and it'll be such a distant past situation that they're remembering. These past threats. When they think about the conquering armies that would come in and control the city's wealth and tribute and defenses, you know, where is the one who counted? The one who weighed tribute, who counted the towers? They'll all be gone. Those who came in and conquered, they will be removed. See, for God's people, when he finally brings these promises in full, there will be no conquering, no threat of subjugation. The king's people will be defended and safe and secure. We continue on, verse 20. Behold Zion, the city of our appointed feasts. Your eyes will see Jerusalem, an untroubled habitation, an unmovable tent, whose stakes will never be plucked up, nor will any of its cords be broken. The king's people will at last have rest. They will have the Lord with them, this fellowship with God that's described here as this place of their feasts, Jerusalem, this place where they have communion with God. They'll be able to rest there forever. They won't need to pick up their homes again and go on the move, to go to somewhere else that's going to be safe for them, like they had to do with the tabernacle in the days of the wilderness, where the Lord was with them, but they had to move on from place to place until they were looking for that promised land when they would finally have rest. No, the Lord's people will be firmly established and have rest with him forever. And then verses 21 and 22. But there the Lord in majesty will be for us a place of broad rivers and streams where no galley with oars can go, nor majestic ship can pass. For the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our king, he will save us. Again, they will have this undisturbed fellowship with God, safe from any threat. No warship will be able to take them. They have the Lord with them. Now, verse 23, now this is tricky. Your cords hang loose. They cannot hold the mast firm in its place or keep the sail spread out. Then prey and spoil and abundance will be divided, even the lame will take the prey. Now this is what takes all of these blessings and puts it in a gospel focus for us. You see, the king's people, they cannot steer the ship themselves. They cannot handle the ship. They cannot win the victory themselves, but instead they get to join in the victory of another. The victory that the king has won. Even the lame will take the prey. They will be able to join in the spoils of victory. And so the king's people, they might try to live as the king wants, but that is not what earns them this victory. It is given to them by grace. And lastly, verse 21. And no inhabitant will say, I am sick. The people who dwell there will be forgiven their iniquity. So lastly, with all of these blessings, this safety and security given, this fellowship with the Lord given, we are finally presented with healing. Not just physical healing, but their sins, their iniquity, that very thing which was the cause for such separation from God in the first place, that will be dealt with. That will be gone, forgiven. So these are the blessings promised to the King's people, the blessings ultimately promised to you and me if we will trust in him. And they're vast promises, aren't they? They are vast beyond imagining. Ultimate safety, security, fellowship with God, and restoration. Vast promises, and wonderfully, they are sure promises. These are promises that can be trusted. Because as we see, as we go through Scripture and we get to the New Testament, as we get to the Gospels, we find that Christ the King has already come and has begun to win all this for his people. He came and defeated the greatest enemies of sin and death for us. Our iniquity, our sin has been dealt with. And we have fellowship with God even now by his Spirit within us. And so we can see his track record continuing to be flawless and spotless. And so as we look ahead to the future, we can trust and we can rest that, in the truth that the fullness will come. The fullness of all these promises will be ours. So there is a choice for each of us this evening. The King or some other salvation provider. To be one of the King's people or to be one of the kingless. We have a choice, but the options are not alike. That is what Isaiah is trying to stress to his readers, to Judah, to us this evening. There is a choice, but it is a clear and obvious one. It is the choice between death or life, destruction or restoration, emptiness or eternal fullness. Sure, the way of the kingless may seem appealing on the surface, but only on the surface. It is empty at its core. So tonight, each one of us is called to see clearly, to wipe away the blurring distractions that the world offers, and to see the King and the fullness that is in him, and to trust him and him alone.